Hello, and welcome to Sounding Out with Izzy, the podcast where we have conversations with musicians, music producers, publicists, live promoters, zine makers, journalists, and more about their experiences working in the music industry as women, non-binary, and queer people. I'm your host, Isabel Korp, the founder of the queer femme music-based blog and YouTube channel, A Girl's Two Sound Sense. Today, I chat with German synth-pop artist Luna Morgenstern about her latest project, Dance Dance Don't Go, the process of taking the scary, unknowable leap of quitting her job to pursue music full-time, and how it paid off, thanks to her tireless work ethic and self-determination. We also discuss her love of PC music and early 2000s Belgian pop artists. And without further ado, let's get right into this episode.
Can you see me?
Yes, I can see you.
Great. Hi. I just arrived at a friend's house, so I hope everything is working fine.
Yeah, I can hear you and see you perfectly, so everything is in working order.
Great.
That's what we like to hear.
Great. How are you doing?
I'm doing good. I'm staying at a family friend's house in Massachusetts right now because I had a huge lineup of doctor appointments. So to start, I'll start by asking you, what is your name? What time is it? And where are you?
My name is Luna. It's 4 p.m. and I'm here in Noordwijk, which is a very, cute little village by the sea in the Netherlands. I studied in the Netherlands in Enschede, which is pretty close to the German border. And after I finished my studies, I did an internship in Amsterdam. And I just really like the city. And I don't know, it has like sort of a laid back and free vibe to it that really, that I really kind of appreciate up until now. If I leave, I always miss it. So I tend to come back.
What was this internship?
I did an internship at an agency that specializes in advertising music. So basically what I did was produce music there and also work with other musicians and writers and creating lots and lots of music in a short amount of time for advertising. It's quite, to be honest, like most of the times it's very practical writing. So I'm not saying that there's not a lot of room for creativity, but because there is a limited amount of time and you work with very short deadlines, you have to be very much to the point. So there is no writing room. Most of the time, what I would do is like write a pitch to different writers and they would all go and work on the pitch separately in order to make sure that, within the deadline, you have the music ready. So it was a very pragmatic way of working, I would say. Yeah.
So that's interesting. It almost sounds like you would put together an outline. If I'm correct, would it just be like, I want you to produce this type of sound with this instrument, and then have it be counteracted with this synth or this very practical sounding bass?
and then have it
ready for the agency by the deadline. That's
exactly like,
yeah.
Yeah. So, I mean, there's still room for creativity, but I mean, I definitely romanticized the job when I started out. I thought that, I would be able to just, produce music and learn a lot. And that all happened, but it was very much catering to a client in the end, So that's also the reason why I wanted to leave that job after 2 years. I was kind of done with it and I wanted to follow my passion, really, just what is that is making music. And so I quit my job and then focused on doing what I'm doing now. Like, I started writing songs for my solo project and really went into that phase, which I'm very happy about.
Yeah, if we could take it on back a little bit, what types of music were you listening to growing up?
It was very varied. So I think what inspired this record that I just released was Eurodance and trance, so more electronic music, I'd say, that I happened to grow up with because my parents were apart and I spent a lot of time in, I don't know how you call that in English, but it's like, you know, after school, you go to daycare, I guess, and you do your homework and stuff and hang out with your peers. So I spent a lot of time there and we used to have like a stash of CDs. And that's basically what my musical education was for a while. Just like the stash of random CDs that other kids brought or parents had left behind, you know. And yeah, those tended to be mostly like mashup hits of the 2000s, you know, and it was kind of cringe, but I still have like a big love for these, I guess, compilations of music. So that's like a source of inspiration for me. And then for the rest, my dad is also a musician. So I grew up with like what he used to love to listen to. So that's the Beatles and lots of bossa nova groups and samba. So it's varied, the music that I would listen to as a child.
It sounds like it. And how and when did you start making music yourself?
Yeah, so I have my dad as a role model, so music was always in my life. And I guess it was always, you know, I always looked up to him. So I always wanted to do something with music. There's like very early recordings of me when I was like, I think 4 years old, where I was just experimenting with my dad's gear because he had like a studio in the living room. But I also was kind of intimidated by him. So it took me, yeah, I guess in my teens, I started to admit or be more vocal about the dream or my passion. But yeah, it took me quite a long time to speak up about it and like tell my dad like, hey, I actually also want to do music. And yeah, I would say in my late teens, when I had to decide, you know, what I'm going to do after school, that's when I started to apply for universities and stuff. That's when I first really said, hey, I want to do this.
And like you mentioned, these Eurodance, or be it like classic rock or bossa nova stuff your father was playing, how do you feel like they've made an imprint on the type of music that you're producing at the moment?
I think, yeah, it's hard to tell. I mean, when I write music, I always look back at, I guess, stuff or music that I used to listen to, but it's more of an unconscious process. I think looking back, I then can tell what happened. It's not like that I, while writing, already know what it's going to be. It's always more like looking back, I realize like, oh, you know, apparently with this past record, Eurodance kind of played a big role. But yeah, I mean, I find this to be a very hard question because what I listen to is always fluctuating. And I feel like everything that I've listened to sort of plays a role at a certain point, but I can't really point to my one big source, I guess. I don't know. I find it a bit hard because it's like I listen to so much music and I never really can tell what has influenced me like so much. In order to come to this point where I am now, I can tell you what inspires me at the moment or who I look up to at the moment, but I really find it hard.
Yeah, if you want to get into who you're really loving at the moment or who is inspiring you, go ahead, because yeah. I feel like there's so much great material being produced right now.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, I do love, in the past couple of years, I was really into PC music and A.T. Cook. That was really interesting to me, that kind of hyper pop approach to production. And through that, I discovered Caroline Polachek. And I kind of rediscovered that I used to listen to a lot of Chairlift, but I didn't make the connection. Because when I was like 16, 17, I went through this more folky indie rock phase, I think that everyone was in back then. And then later I started listening to Chairlift when I started university, but I didn't get like the connection with Caroline Polachek later. But yeah, I really love her approach to songwriting and production as well. I think she's an amazing artist and role model for me. And yeah, I also really love Shy Girl and Sega Bodega. So that's like definitely influences for the music that I make.
Yeah, Chairlift, I think one of their songs was in like a 2008 iPod commercial or something like that.
Exactly. Yeah.
Yeah. And then she just re-emerged, just being the phoenix that she is. It's incredible to see like
Yeah.
how she's reinvented herself. And yeah, it's interesting that you mention PC music because I feel like this latest project that you released, I definitely could hear like those imprints in some of the different sounds and the vibe of the production and all
Yeah.
that. What, and if you'd like to tell me a little bit about the type, the angle that you write from when it comes to subject matter or an overall concept of a project, what is your normal approach to that kind of stuff? Is it normally unconscious?
So I kind of let go of that for myself. I'm not a conceptual writer at first. I think what I need to do is just create. And then afterwards, I look back and I kind of draw the connection between the songs, whether that be like lyrically, but also production-wise. And then bring them together and see and connect the dots, like, how does this actually connect? And then when writing lyrically, it's most of the times it's just sort of a therapy session. Yeah, it's most of the time it's stuff that is close to me that happened and that I have to sort of reflect on that ends up in a song. And yeah, with this EP, Dance, Dance, Don't Go, it was written during the end of the second lockdown phase here. And I think I had just lots of time on my hands and it was very kind of introspect because I found a diary from my childhood and I read a couple, like kind of read it and re-experienced some of my like early teen childhood memories. And that's what influenced the record a lot. So there's a song about, for example, where I look back at the relationship I have with my mom, who passed away a couple of years ago, and how I dealt with that within my early teens. So it's most of the time it's kind of me going through something in a therapeutic way when I'm writing a song. And because I kind of reflect on my early teens, I also decided to bring that back in the production and to use Eurodance and trance synths or drums in the production to kind of tie that together.
How do you feel that songwriting, if we could go into the therapy session and reflection aspect of it, how do you feel like that has like affects you personally in the moment versus after it's happened and after it's all like on the page?
It definitely feels cathartic. That's when it's not with every song, but for example, The Day I Die, where I reflect on, the relationship I have had with my mom as a teenager, that definitely felt like, yeah, kind of a weight that has been lifted off my shoulders. I still find it hard to perform it because it it deals with a lot of guilt that I have, that I feel towards my mom, because I just didn't spend enough time with her looking back. So it's definitely a hard one to perform live, but it's also, yeah, it speaks truth. So it's also, it's always feels good to sing it as well. It's like a double-edged sword. Yeah.
What do you think it is about dance music in particular that makes it so ever-present and timeless?
I think that it's based on this feeling of losing yourself in music, and because dance music is so repetitive and you have like a fixed rhythm that is achieved quite easily, I would say. So for me, I think that's why it will always play a role in my music, because it kind of embodies that escapism, I'd say. So that's a topic in my songwriting lyrically a lot as well. So it kind of goes well together. Yeah.
I agree for sure. I can tell you, I will be the first to admit that there has never been a time that I danced more than when I was stuck in my bedroom during social distancing restrictions in 2020.
It's funny how that goes. As soon as you can't anymore, you want to do exactly that so bad. Yeah, that definitely played a role when writing that record, that craving to lose yourself to music and in a crowd as well.
Definitely. What sort of things were in rotation for you at the time, like on your playlists and stuff, specifically like during like lockdown restrictions?
What was on rotation? Definitely Bunny is a Rider, because that came out 2021, I think. And it was just a hit. I mean, I couldn't refuse it. So good. And then I was listening to lots of OK Lou, because she also released her Galore towards, like, you know, that sort of half lockdown period, like 2021, late 2021, I think. And that kind of was my lockdown soundtrack, because it combined a very, or it combines a very dreamy, soundscapey, almost cinematic approach with like a more danceable sound. And I still really love listening to it. It's like, it's a great record.
Well, also, I feel like, I mean, well, it's cool to talk about like specifically during times where something that feels so vital and that maybe we take for granted when we're out and about is just like completely stripped away, and then that's when it's more necessary than ever. As far as a return to live music has been since, I guess, 2021, how do you feel you've personally been adjusting to, I guess, the return to IRL events? Do you feel like it's officially like revived, or do you feel like there's the maybe some of the problems that were there, like when it comes to like, I don't know, touring complications and finances and stuff like that, or just physical like safety? Do you feel like you're noticing that more as it's come back, or do you feel like relieved? Like what are your feelings as far as the return?
I mean, I definitely looked forward to it, but I also knew that I had to figure out a way to make my set more, like, basically make it smaller so that I could travel more with it and be more flexible with gigs, because I used to play together with a drummer, but he lives in Germany, and it just wasn't financially possible for me after COVID to make that happen still with travel costs, because touring is just expenses all of the time, and most of the time is no pay, unfortunately. So I just wanted to find a way how I could carry the set by myself. And I also thought it would be like a good challenge for me personally to make, you know, to just try that out for once, because I've always had a band or like a buddy that would carry it with me. So it was kind of exciting, but also scary to look into that. And I spent, a good 2 months on figuring out how I would create my life set within Ableton, what I would play live and how I would give it form. And then in, May and June, I went on a support tour with Frauke, who is a big success in the Netherlands. So I could put it to the test for the first time. And it was really an amazing experience to play the new record in front of people and already just test it out before it came out and see how people react to the songs, but also to just realize that it's possible for me to do this by myself. And, you know, it was a very freeing experience to just kind of know that I can do it, you know, and if I want to go back to playing with a band, that's still possible, but I'm able to do this by myself. So for me, kind of that was my revelation around playing live after COVID.
Yeah. What are some examples of those like live hacks that you found you were able to do, like with getting around the lack of a live band?
I think for me, it was very important to make very clear that, you know, I will have to work, and I am working with lots of stuff, like lots of tape, basically backing track. So I wanted to give that form in like a fun way. And as my music is very inspired from the early 2000s, I kind of wanted to create an installation that is my karaoke computer station, because I also create my music in my bedroom and have like a little, I don't know, I guess like nerdy corner with all my instruments and like gear. And I kind of wanted to recreate that on stage and to show people how I work, like not literally, but figuratively. So I have like an installation with a couple of TVs and interfaces and a big monitor on top where Ableton is playing, and people can actually see, at least people in the first row, can see what is happening within Ableton while I'm doing my set. So I wanted to be super transparent on that aspect. Like, I have to rely on backing tracks in order to play my music the way people expect it to sound. So that was one aspect. And then I kind of picked out the moments that I felt were important within the sound that I wanted to play live. Obviously, I sing everything live, but I kind of recreated the most iconic and important synth sounds and play them live. And, you know, guitar bits I added to some of the songs in order to make it a bit more like interesting, I guess. So yeah, I'm rambling, but I hope I answered that question.
That's really cool. So do you like project like the waveforms, like as they're going, like on stage while you're playing?
Yes. So
nice. That's really cool.
I thought so too. I thought I wanted to be like super open about, you know, what I'm doing, and just that people share that knowledge in a way. If you want, you know, if you like the show, people come after and just ask me like, hey, how's that working? How do you use autotune on that track? And how do you automate this? Like, these are the conversation I'd like to have with people.
That's awesome. That's really interesting to add like the visual aspect of like the process, as it were.
Yeah, exactly.
And were there any songs on the EP that you found the most difficult to write?
Yes, I mean, it took me a long time to write I Don't Owe You, and that's because of the subject matter. So the song is about sexual abuse at a talent show in the Netherlands. And last year was a big scandal when it came to the surface. And I felt very like I needed to write about this because it happened in the music industry out in the open. And it kind of, I don't know. It just made me very angry and touched on like experiences and feelings that I guess every woman knows, but I had suppressed for a long time working in the industry. And I wanted to find a way to write about it that did the victims justice, the subject justice, and also like sort of you know, I wanted it to be, and that's contradictive, but I want it to be like a fun song that people can actually move to and feel good about when they're listening to it. So that was definitely a challenge for me to find the right words, but also to make it very euphoric in a way. So that song, I worked like, I think I worked on it for 3 months in total, just the lyrics to get them where I wanted them to be. And then at a later point, I came back to the production. So it was a long process, but also a very satisfying process, because now that I play it live, it really reacts with people. Especially, you know, I take a moment to tell them what it's about. And then when the beat hits, you really get like an emotional, powerful, sort of angry, but yet like physical reaction. And that is exactly what I wanted for it to be. So, yeah.
Yeah, I'm curious, were you ever like a Sheryl Crow fan at all?
No.
So I haven't been all that familiar with her catalog until I watched the recent documentary. I can't remember if it's on Showtime or HBO, but it's just called Sheryl. And something really revealing that I learned was that one of her really early songs, What I Can Do For You, was written about her experience with sexual harassment at the hands of Frank DeLeo, who was Michael Jackson's manager at the time. And you would never guess that listening to the song. It sounds like a really nice, like Americana-esque, like flavored pop song, but when you just dig beneath the surface, it's really interesting. Like, she just sings from the perspective of this slimy, like gross executive. And I'm pretty sure like this man, like, because she name dropped him in the song, tried to sue her for defamation or something after that. And like, when you think of Sheryl Crow, you just think of like this force of nature who nobody could ever hurt. But like, and the fact that this song had come out in like, I don't know, like 90s to early 2000s, like this could have ended her career.
Yeah.
But it's really awesome just like to, when you like really dig deeper and you learn about like all the interesting things behind the scenes that inspired them, a lot of stuff that was often really grim too. Like, and like, it's interesting, like you said, making it a song that you can groove to, but while, which I guess makes the more grim subject matter a little, go down a little easier in a way. Would you agree?
Yeah, I guess. I mean, I think for me, it's always interesting to look for a contrast between subject matter and sound. So I think initially I thought, you know, the more people it reaches, the better, because then more people hear about it. And there are so many hits that are about very like serious subjects where you would never, when you listen to them, especially, you know, when you're young, and my English wasn't existent when I was a child. So a lot of these songs later on in life, you understand what they are actually about. And that is, then they hit even harder. And I think that's like a super interesting thing to play with when writing songs. And I also thought, you know, the more people actually initially like the song because of maybe just sonically, and when they later on understand what it's about, hopefully it gets people to thinking. Yeah.
Yeah. It's interesting, but it's also sometimes scary when you think of like the death grip, like, power that music has over all of us. It's really interesting because, like, have you ever like had an experience where you read the lyrics to a song and you were like, oh my god, these are really problematic, but then like when you hear them like sung in a really pretty melody, you're like, oh, that doesn't sound so bad. Oh wait, oh shit, oh no.
Yeah.
Yeah,
I think it's so interesting what delivery can do to lyrics. And it's definitely a talent, you know. It can be dangerous, but it can also be like amazing at the same time. So, you know, I always try my best with my lyrics. And for me as a non-native, I know that I will always fall short in a way, you know. But on the other hand, I also feel like, you know, there's sort of charm to me not knowing all the ins and outs and not knowing all the references, because I will come up with my own or like sort of translate the references that I grew up with in Germany or wherever, you know, and make that into something new that hasn't existed before. So I think it's super interesting what delivery then can do to a lyric as well. How you can carry that even further, even though you might not be like a native. There's interesting nuances to that. Yeah,
for sure. Like language, like music is the ultimate universal language.
Absolutely. Yeah.
It just breaks everything down, which is like part of the magic for sure. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And you mentioned earlier that you really love like a lot of early 2000s like hits, like on these compilation CDs that you found. Who would you say are like some of your top like references, like any specific bands you can name?
Yeah, so I definitely listened to like, those were compilations, so you know, I only had limited access. I just kind of listened to these compilations over and over again. But I know that Gigi D'Agostino had like a big like sort of part on the compilation, like with two or three tracks, for example. There was Roller Girl, but Roller Girl was mentioned about a lot. Then also ATC, lots of Belgian artists in general. So yeah, I think these were kind of influential for these, for this type of like Eurodance craze at the time.
Absolutely. And one of my final questions is, what does the rest of the year have in store for you?
So it's very exciting. I have my first headline shows coming up in the Netherlands. And by the end of September, I will do three shows in Amsterdam, Utrecht, and Nijmegen, which is super exciting because that gives me the, you know, space and room to also create my own world on stage. So I'm really looking forward to that. And then I also have a couple of festivals. I'm playing Reeperbahn Festival in Germany, which is, for me, that's a big deal. Like that's a big goal of mine because it's like a newcomer festival that kind of dictates, you know, who will be booked in the next year's festival round. So I'm really preparing for that. And I'm in London for two shows and some sessions. So definitely a busy like summer and early autumn with shows. And at the same time in the summer, I'm writing on my first.
Very exciting.
Yeah.
Well, Luna, thank you so much for joining me for this chat. Where can people find you online?
Yeah, thank you so much for this chat as well. And yeah, I'm on Instagram and TikTok. And you can find my music anywhere in all the DSPs.
Amazing.
And yeah, it was lovely chatting to you.
Thank you so much for listening to Sounding Out with Izzy, and thank you to Luna Morgenstern for joining me for this episode. Dance Dance Don't Go is available on all DSPs. Remember to subscribe and sign up for the mailing list on my YouTube channel and written blog, both under the name A Girl's Two Sound Sense. Give the podcast a 5-star rating and review on Apple Podcasts or wherever you get your podcasts. Thank you so much for listening, and I will catch you in the next episode of Sounding Out with Izzy.